It's Legal Defense with Kirk O'Bear on 1330 and 101.5 WHBL.
Good morning and welcome to Legal Defense with Kirk and John.
Morning, Kirk.
Our second show officially renamed as such.
Really has a nice ring to it.
If you notice, last week we changed it. Yeah, it's got a nice ring to it.
I like it. I like that.
Way better than John and Kirk. I don't like that.
Yeah, you know, I was thinking about that, and, you know, you got to stay in your lane sometimes and just know your place in life. So, yes, Kirk and John. Right.
Precisely. Hey, let's start right off, because this was something that was brewing last week but was not quite mature enough in the media to discuss just yet, so we held off just to make sure we knew exactly what was happening. Although we're still not sure exactly what's happening. The Brendan Dassey issue, of course, a lot of people were much more upset with Dassey's conviction than even Stephen Avery's conviction in the Making a Murderer Netflix documentary. And I know I, for one, was extremely disappointed with how that case went down.
Well, I think,
and a lot of that's,
yeah, I think the reason that people were upset about it is because that was a case where somebody, just a lay person, can watch that and see for themselves the manipulation that was going on, and really, I guess, pull back the curtain of the criminal justice system and see what the wizard's doing back there, because it's really shocking to a lot of people. That's what people ask me all the time, what I think about this. And this is really what they're talking about. It's not so much Stephen Avery. Yeah. It's somewhat Stephen Avery, but it's mostly Brendan Dassey.
And, sure. And so all the rebuttals, so to speak, that have been issued by way of print or other media have focused on the evidence relating to Avery. I didn't hear anything since that documentary came out about the propriety of Dassey's conviction. I mean, no one's been out there defending it, in my mind. But anyway, interestingly enough, a habeas corpus petition, which was filed in the Eastern District of Wisconsin, interestingly enough, decided by a magistrate judge. And a little bit of background here. When a habeas corpus petition is filed, the reason that is done is that someone has exhausted all of their state court remedies, but there remains an issue where the federal courts have jurisdiction to rule on something that relates to a federal right in some sort. And most of our most basic constitutional rights can be said to fall within that realm. And what the federal district court at that point has to look at are several things. Number one, has the person truly exhausted all of their state court remedies? And secondly, is it something where it doesn't rely solely upon state law for a remedy and actually does implicate a federal constitutional issue? There are many habeas corpus petitions filed every day,
yes,
throughout the United States. In fact, they have special divisions of the U.S. Attorney's Office and the Federal Defender's Office in most jurisdictions, and even special clerks assigned to judges that simply handle habeas matters. And the vast majority of them, I don't know what percentage, but I'd have to guess about 90%, are dismissed without further review, without further briefing, without any evidence being taken, no hearings. In other words, the petitioner, which is a prisoner. Oh, and by the way, you have to establish that you are, quote unquote, in the custody of the state in order to file a federal habeas petition, at least of this variety. Now, there is another variety whereby somebody's in federal custody and they're filing a federal habeas petition after they have worked their way through in our jurisdiction, it would be the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals and through the United States Supreme Court. And you get another crack at it on a 2255 type motion. But anyway, going back to how it normally works when there's a state court issue, it's really viewed as kind of the last resort and the long shot, the Hail Mary. The Hail Mary of litigation is when somebody files for habeas corpus relief, because that means you've struck out every time you were at bat up until that point.
Yeah, which is why so few of these are ever granted. And this is
right,
really a truly remarkable ruling.
Yeah, and you know, the basic rule here is that the federal court is not supposed to get involved in tampering with state court proceedings. I mean, that's really the nature of states' rights, states, you know, states making their own laws that can vary somewhat. They cannot be less protective of constitutional rights, however. So, it, really interesting opinion. It's 93 pages, which is
remarkable.
I couldn't believe it was that long when I finished reading it because it was like a page turner.
Well, most of it was about the facts. You know, a very meticulous exploration of the facts, and they were, and it was very objective too. I might add. Of course, you really didn't have to reach far to find to be aghast at what happened here with Len Kaczynski.
Right. You pretty much get the gist of it pretty early in the whole thing. But, I mean, you know, makes for a good night's reading.
Again, you know, even lay people are going to look at this and go, this is crazy. This guy is unfit, and he assigns his prosecutor to extract a confession from his own client. You know, I mean, fantastic. But this is what was really amazing was that the federal magistrate said to the state court, which upheld the conviction and upheld the confession, and he said to them, you have ignored settled federal law, federal constitutional law. You just ignored it, and you are wrong, and that's why I'm granting this. And he ordered him released in 90 days unless they retry him.
Well, that's the standard remedy if a habeas is granted. After the initial petition is not denied, then there's briefing that occurs, and then there can be evidentiary hearings. This is supposed to go relatively quickly, but I believe this petition was filed in 2014. Anyway, it didn't go as quickly as Mr. Dassey would like. So, yes, you're right. As of last Friday, the state now has the option of either releasing him in 90 days or recharging him within that time period. He remains in custody until that decision is made. But let's talk about the real reasons why this petition was granted.
Why
it's so extraordinary. Of course, you know from watching the documentary that the involvement of Len Kaczynski and his investigator, with whom he had not worked with before, as it came out during this opinion, the combination of the quote-unquote investigator having a particular agenda and Kaczynski not deciding on his defense until he made several media appearances and was more or less guessing at what path this case would take, it completely bypassed the confrontational, adversarial nature of all criminal litigation.
No, he completely abandoned his duty as an attorney, as an advocate for a client. He completely abandoned it.
Did you see that by the time this first interview with the investigator was conducted, Kaczynski had spent less than 1 hour speaking with the client and over 10 hours speaking with the media?
Yeah.
Here's
the other thing. Here's the other thing with the way he conducted this is that he said, he's quoted in The Guardian as saying, and I'm paraphrasing here, but it's approximately as follows. I looked at this confession, and I didn't see anything particularly suggestive about it. I didn't see anything wrong with it. It didn't look like a false confession. It didn't look like it had the markers of a false confession. To which the lawyer who represented him on the habeas from the Wrongful Conviction Center in Chicago, Laura Ricciardi, I believe, who is I don't really know her very well, but she does some brilliant work here. But she's like, this is exactly what a false confession looks like to a T. I mean, point by point by point, and having worked on a false confession case a few years ago, which I talk about ad nauseum, I know, but I'm very familiar with what results in a false confession. It's things like this sort of manipulation by the police, false promises, intellectual defects on the part of the suspect. All of these things are present with Dassey. And you know, extended questioning and lack of counsel. So it's remarkable that Kaczynski was so displaced and so disassociated from his own job, and he was a public defender appointment. And this is the larger issue, which we can pick up after the break if we want. But this is sort of, in my mind at least, this is the larger issue. This is what $40 an hour gets poor people in Wisconsin. This is the kind of lawyer.
If you're not poor enough to get the actual public defender's office. If you're not poor enough, you get Kaczynski'd. That's what happens.
Oh, boy. Now it's a verb. Okay.
Yeah, I think the Oxford English Dictionary has approved the word Kaczynski as a verb.
Yeah. Okay.
To be Kaczynski'd.
Oh, that's so terrible. All right. Well,
we are coming up on our break, so let's do that so that our sponsors can talk to you, and then you'll have a chance to hear our wonderful, delightful voices right after these messages. Stay tuned. This is Legal Defense with Kirk and John.
You're listening to Legal Defense with Kirk O'Bare on 1330 and 101.5 WHBL.
Welcome back. This is Legal Defense with Kirk and John. Did I get that right? Kirk and John?
You did.
Okay.
You did.
Just wanted to make sure, and we were just following up on talking about Brendan Dassey's conviction being overturned. And I guess the point I was making before was that this, you know, this you can do this with any case in particular, but this really speaks to a couple of broader questions, and that is, one is that we have very, very low quality attorneys sometimes taking these $40 an hour cases, and this is the result. This is the sort of stuff that goes on. That's number one. And but number two is, and it's an even bigger, awful question, which is, I don't think that the two investigators here, one from the Department of Justice in Madison and the other was a local sheriff's deputy, they don't think they did anything wrong. They think yeah. They think everything they did was just fine, and that was a valid confession. And this,
well, that's because it still is a persistent belief amongst law enforcement that have been trained using the Reed techniques.
Mm-hmm. Yep, which they all deny, of course, but
over decades. Well, I know that they have been. They just don't call it that. They don't.
I know.
But the same material is referenced.
Oh, I know.
In all of their training. And the belief is that false confessions don't occur. I mean, that's the prevailing thought amongst law enforcement and prosecutors.
Even though there's a plethora of evidence, including many, many, many exonerations, DNA exonerations, that prove without a shadow of a doubt that false confessions do indeed occur. And yet,
it's a troubling thought. I mean, I understand why there's some resistance philosophically to the idea, because if it's true, which we know it's true, it really undermines everyone's faith in the justice system. I mean, it really does. It's an uncomfortable truth.
That's absolutely correct. That's absolutely right. And that's really the larger question. In fact, I think that is really a segue into talking about the reports that have come out recently, one report on Ferguson and two, a report on the Baltimore Police Department about their systemic failures in terms of police abuses, racial profiling, unconstitutional, you know, search and seizures and arrests, that sort of thing. And the problem in all of those instances, and we can certainly talk about the Milwaukee Police Department, too, in that same breath. But the problem with all of those instances is that there's a culture in place that you just can't change. And they don't think they're doing anything wrong, the police, because they were trained by their sergeants and their lieutenants and their commanders and their colonels on down the line. And you just don't root out a cultural attitude, I guess, that easily. You know, and then I mean, look at the Milwaukee County Sheriff's Department, David Clark. Look at the culture that he is trying to. He's actually more of a figurehead, but you know, rather than a true leader. But you can see it's that everybody is scum that we arrest. If we determine they're worthy of arrest, that means they're scum. They can be beaten. They can be abused. They can be detained. You know, illegally or whatever. We don't really care. because most of this isn't going to see the light of day in court in terms of our errors. So, I mean...
But you know what? I think the problem is much more complicated than that, because I think there are plenty of police that are out there that are contributing to this problem and don't even realize it. And that's the nature of the issue, is that 100%. It's systemic. It's systemic. And that's why you have to look at statistical information, because it gives you a broader stroke picture on where these problems lie. Now, let's not forget that a police on the job is dealing mostly with bad guys. I mean, that's how they're trained, is that it's you know, find the bad guys out there. Your job is to root them out. And, you know, that's not necessarily an inaccurate or overly controversial way of stating that. What it really means is that their role being such that if you look at every case that comes down to justifying an officer's decision about, number one, making a stop, number two, effecting an arrest, number three, conducting a search, and number four, how the person, how the interaction ultimately ends up with the person, which... You know, if you ever watch Cops, which is a blast, you know, have a beer or two, sit down and watch Cops, because the gist of the show is look at how far the cops can get away with things. And you know how many times when I watch the show.
And that's when they know they're being taped.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and that's, can you imagine what happens when they're not being taped?
Exactly. But it's almost like they pick out the circumstances where, as if it's a joke, you know, that the person wouldn't have been arrested, wouldn't have gotten in trouble, but for the fact that they did something slightly wrong in the process of the officer giving commands to him. Yeah, it's like the most common scenario you see is when someone's saying, I'm not resisting, and then they're beating him saying, stop resisting. And I'm not resisting. Stop resisting. I'm going to tase you. I'm not resisting. Zap, you know?
Right, right.
But, you know, again, this culture, it's a... You know, it's almost impossible to identify the source of it. And this is something that I dealt with very frequently in the military. And I think it was exacerbated somewhat in the military because, depending on what branch you're talking about, but it is something that is, I think, universal amongst all branches of our military, is that it's a microcosm of society on a larger level. So if you look at everything that happens in the United States, boil it down to on a smaller level, almost a sub level. What you have are people from all over the country with all different backgrounds and all different motivations for why they're in the military. We have a substantial number of people that are taking advantage of GI Bill benefits, or people that want to further their education, or people that want to develop skills and use them in the civilian world. Then we have people that appreciate the opportunity to serve their country and make a career out of it and be part of that military family. And then we have people that want to, you know, kill terrorists that go in for that reason. And so it's really a mix of all different motivations, just like we have in the country. Very interesting, the way that things happen when no one's watching, and how a subculture of misconduct can be bred without the actors even realizing that it is misconduct. I had a case where it was just unbelievable how far from the regulations and other restrictions on prison guards had strayed from the proper way to do things. And, I had a client that was reporting substantial jaw-dropping abuses where he was being detained. And I have to admit, when I first heard these allegations, I was doubtful because it was so extreme. Come to find out, after launching an investigation with the internal investigation, OSI, in the Air Force, it turns out everything this guy said was true, was absolutely true, and was, in fact, documented. It was on a par with Abu Ghraib, you know, the types of things that were being done.
Thanks.
And it was obviously a failure of leadership, but it was also new people that were being brought into this particular military prison were not aware that, you know, they were being influenced in such subtle ways. And it's the old problem with military training. it's very strict, very disciplined, very much by the book, and the rules are black and white when you're in boot camp. Then when you go to your first duty assignment, they tell you, well, that's what you learned in school, but here's how it works in the real world.
Right.
And, I know we're supposed to do it that way, but it doesn't work.
That's an exact parallel. That's an exact parallel to civilian police work.
So my point here is that if we're looking toward a solution to this problem, we've identified the problem. There's no debate that there's a problem, okay? And even police will admit that, yes, it appears to be a problem. But the question is, how do you fix it? Step one is to identify if there is or isn't a problem. Second step is, what can be done about it? And that's a very difficult question to answer, because it's going to involve, I think, oversight, much more oversight than the police want. I think the use of body cams should be something that would contribute positively to that. But also, what they did in the military when things were going astray is that they stripped everything down to its core and retrained everybody from scratch and brought in people that could extinguish whatever influences had led to
That is very funny that you should say that, because that is exactly what is being proposed
recalibrate.
I think they need to root out the bad apples in some of these departments. But if you look at both Ferguson, which is a smaller town, but also Baltimore, a major American city, and what needs to be done there to change the culture, well, it needs to be changed from top to bottom. I mean, literally from top to bottom. If you read the report on Baltimore from the Justice Department about, we're coming up on our break.
Dr. John, hold that thought.
Got it.
We've got to take a break, but we'll be right back. We'll pick up right where you left off. Please stay tuned. It's Legal Defense with Kirk and John.
Now, back to Legal Defense with Kirk O'Bear on 1330 and 101.5 WHBL.
Back to Legal Defense with Kirk and John. John, I rudely interrupted you because our commercial sponsors were knocking on the door.
Very upset about it.
Well, it's not my fault. We got to pay the bills.
I understand that. I understand that completely. So what we were talking about was these the Justice Department's very, very thorough report. I don't know if you had a chance to read it, but it's really remarkable. It really addresses this issue of police culture. And I think that the Baltimore Police Department, and of course, if you watch The Wire, you're kind of familiar with it, but Baltimore Police Department is like many other police departments. It's a little more egregious, probably, than, say, Milwaukee, but it's still, I think, a template for police problem areas that they need to work on. And I don't mean this to sound as a condemnation of all police. We need police in a free society. We just do. I mean, it's just human nature to need that form of organizational control over a society. I mean, it's just – that is true. But
well, they're supposed to help, too. Yeah. They're helping agencies.
Yeah, no, and I totally respect that and get that. But the problem is that there's this – at least from my view, this is it's also the Justice Department's view, but there's two big problems. One is the us versus them, and two is racial bias. And the us versus them is that we're the police. We're going to cover for each other. There's this blue shield, the thin blue line, whatever moniker you want to use about how special we are as police, and that we're granted this special place in society because we have this badge which connotes authority, and we also have on our hips the ability to take away life. At our whim, we do, or inflict severe injury. And so this us versus them is a very, very dangerous thing, I think. And when you combine that with concentrating your efforts in communities of color, that's a real problem. I mean, if you look in that Justice Department report, there was a number of examples of situations where – Justice Department officials were riding around with Baltimore police officers. And the police officers were right in front of the federal officials doing things like this one example is the sergeant ordered this one cop to get out and order these kids off the street, and then the cop says, "Well, but they didn't do anything wrong. I mean, what basis do I have for that?" He goes, he says this in front of the federal official. He says, "Go make something up." Okay. Mm-hmm. And because, you know, right. because that's the way he was taught. That was the way he was taught. Several other examples are of people, officers who were afraid to turn in fellow officers for really egregious conduct, because if they did, they would be ostracized, or even worse, they would be in a bad situation and nobody would come for their backup. And so it's that sort of cultural circling of the wagons, if you will, attitude, that's the real problem, and that's what needs to be rooted out.
Well, and then the us against them problem is, I think, further perpetuated by the appellate courts.
Absolutely.
And here's why.
They give the stamp of approval, a pass
on that kind of thing.
They give them,
right.
Yeah.
Okay, a couple of things that we can say are true and really not debatable. Number one, there are good cops and bad cops in every police agency. So when we're talking about misconduct that rises to the level of denying people of their protected rights, we're not talking about all police, certainly not. Secondly, you had mentioned before that I'll recharacterize it. There is a level of pride that exists in police culture, and some of that is appropriate, but it's when it goes too far where people are basically losing sight of their public servant responsibilities, okay? I don't think there's anything wrong with appreciating what good police work accomplishes in our society, because it is very important. We do live in an era where we need both protection from would-be violent people, and we also need, you know, I think an even more important function is that is your average citizen's contact with the government. You know, that's face-to-face contact with the government. There are people that live every day of their lives without having an actual interface with the government in any other way than dealing with the police. And if you happen to be a black man that drives every day 4 miles to and from work, and in the span of 3 months you get pulled over 18 times, there's something wrong, you know? Mm-hmm. And we have to look at what on earth is going on here. The us versus them thing is something that I think is unabashedly part of police training. And I think the philosophy behind it is to it's a very common sense way of making sure that police are alerted to the possibility of what's awry. And that's been the nature of police work since it began, okay? That, you know, like Sherlock Holmes can tell things about people and what happened and where they've been and what color mud is on their shoes, because he's looking at everything with a skeptical eye, with the idea that, you know, he can solve things by intuition. And that's become sort of an icon in the crime-solving mythology out there. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
The idea that you can divine guilt based upon instinct or a hunch is something that is absolutely pervasive in the police field. I mean, how many times have you done a trial where, you know, if you ask the cop a question such as, well, why do you believe so-and-so's guilty, which, by the way, fortunately, they're not allowed to answer that question as long as you don't ask it.
Yeah, if you were to ask that question, you need to be disbarred.
Yeah, you do. Exactly. But if you were to actually do that, there would be – it wouldn't just be based upon – if you're actually asking the cop to render a personal opinion, not objective, but what do you actually think here, there's a lot of stuff that would come out in virtually every case that has to do with, I can just tell, You know, I can just tell by the way he acted.
I've been doing this job for 20 years. I've been doing this job for so long
that I know the difference.
I can tell when people are lying. Because I look at the carotid artery and it's popping out there, and their eyes are a little shifty. And there's
He looked down. Yeah. He looked to the left.
And
you know, his left foot was tapping.
His nostrils were flaring a little bit.
Okay. So of course none of this stuff is admissible for very good reason. But you know what? It's part of the investigation. And it leads to the evidence gatherer's view on things. So if you wonder why false confessions happen, and you know, a lot of people that are not familiar with normal police interrogation techniques are very surprised to hear this. And that's the funny thing about this whole Dassey case is that, as you said, if you could look up the definition of a false confession,
100%.
It in the Encyclopedia Britannica, it would have this case in it.
Absolutely.
It would say C. Dassey, comma Brendan.
Well,
that's what it would say.
This is a fancy term that that is used to describe this same phenomena that you're talking about. It's called confirmation bias, which I'm sure you are familiar with this term. A lot of people won't be familiar with that term. They might probably know it by a little bit less precise term called tunnel vision. But essentially, it's this. It's Fox News and MSNBC. It's believing what you want to believe. It's a Rorschach test. It's knowing that that I'm going to accept everything that as far as what facts come at me, I'm going to accept those that seem to support what I think already happened, and I'm going to ignore or reject those that don't support it. And that's confirmation bias, and that is endemic. That's exactly what happened with Dassey.
Well, that's human nature.
It is human nature.
I mean, that's
nature.
Something that we...
It absolutely is.
And you have to be aware of it, and you have to be, frankly, really smart. I mean, smarter than I am, probably, or you, to be able to actually put it out of your mind. And let's face it, we have an imperfect system because it's an adversarial system.
Yeah.
But it's the best we can do.
Well, this is how you avoid that, is you bring other people into the process. So, for example, when you or I were making up we're bringing up a case and we're getting our theories together, we're going to like float it by other people because they're going to see things that we subliminally just are not seeing, that we're just not paying attention to, right? I mean, you do that,
right?
I'm sure. I know you do.
Sure.
And
right.
And that's what police need to do. That's why, for example, in identification procedures, they insist on having people not involved do the lineups and do the arrays, and because to eliminate that inherent bias that is going to be present, whether you like it or not. I mean, you're a human being, and you're going to put your thumb on the scale somehow, some way. But if you're coming in objectively, if you're coming in cold, you're not going to do that. Because you can't, because you don't have that internal knowledge already of what the case is about, and so that's part of what needs to take place to take this out of the equation. But it doesn't really; it's still not going to address the top to bottom problem, the problem of sort of rooting out how everybody's been trained for decades and decades and decades. And we could talk about, we're probably up on a break, but we are coming up on a break. We'll talk about it after the break.
Sure. Sounds like a good idea. Stay tuned. This is Legal Defense with Kirk and John.
It's Legal Defense with Kirk O'Bear on 1330 and 101.5 WHBL.
Welcome back. This is Legal Defense with Kirk and John. Hope you enjoy those awesome messages from our sponsors. Well, what we were kind of devolving into was a discussion about, sort of police writ large of cultural problems and the us versus them and the the inherent racial bias. You know who I'm going to give credit to on the racial bias part is FBI Director James Comey, who I'm sure you saw his several remarks on this subject, which I thought were very enlightened in the sense that he's a very conservative Republican law enforcement guy who comes out and says, look, everybody's racist. The cops are racist. They can't help it. They're humans. They're going to have this racial bias. They have to be aware of it, and we have to try and address it. And and it's just, you know, because, you know, that didn't just come out of nowhere. Our country was – racism is baked into the Constitution, for God's sake. And So – It's there. It's something, and I'm always amazed at very intelligent people that I encounter who seem to think that it doesn't exist. Well, they seem to think it doesn't exist because they don't want it to exist, or they just want to.
I mean, there's very few people that want racism to exist. I mean, that they're out there, but I think your average person really does not want to have it, but it's there. That's the problem.
Well, they don't want to believe it.
Acknowledge
there,
that it is.
Probably should be more accurately said.
You know, and that's the one good thing we can say about it is that at least it has become part of our moral fabric that we know it's wrong, okay, and that it's not acceptable to actually hold identifiable racist beliefs that you are conscious of, okay. But if you listen to our good friend Jerry Spence talk about how these types of things influence juries, and it's a good example to talk about how people walk into court to serve as potential jurors with a belief that they want to do good. They want to do good service. They want to be good citizens. They want to participate, assuming that they're not a phantom juror, you know, those that are there to convict no matter what, and they say, I'll be fair to the defense, and they're
absolutely
lying. You know?
Absolutely.
But assuming that there is virtue in this process, which is an ideal, it's something that we're all told and taught. They're thanked for their service, they're treated very well, they're given food and donuts and coffee, and are you comfortable? Everybody stand up, take a deep breath. But in the process of trying to figure out if there is a potential bias, that's the hardest question for someone to answer accurately. I'm not even going to say honestly, because most of us honestly would say, I'm not racist. But the problem is, you know, we're all different people that have all different experiences. And when people naturally have inherent conclusions that they draw. And when someone says everyone is racist, it doesn't mean it's a silly notion that is going overboard in its proximity to the truth. What it really means is we have to identify the fact that it still is a pervasive problem in our society, and you can't just say, that's not me. So what Jerry Spence does whenever he's picking a jury, he has this really delicate way of dealing with it. And what he says is, you know, I know that it is wrong to have racist beliefs.
I know exactly what you're going to say. Yeah.
I do not profess to discriminate against people. I have always admired all races, all people, all religions, all factions of life. It's part of what makes our country great. But I need to be honest with you and tell you something. I have racism. I don't like it. But I'm aware of it because I've thought long and hard about what it really means. And I try to suppress it. I know that it's something that is not appropriate for a forum like this. And I tell myself that I'm a good person and that I couldn't possibly harbor any kind of beliefs. Yet, I have to acknowledge that there is something in the back of my mind when I'm evaluating a case that it's like, don't think about pink elephants. You can't completely suppress it from your mind. So this is where it becomes so important, ladies and gentlemen of the prospective jury. In order to talk about where there might be a bias that you're not really even aware of, we need to talk about these delicate issues. So who here will join me in raising your hand in saying that you have racial bias? Mm-hmm. And he gets everybody to raise their hand when he's explaining it that way. And then they say, you know, thank you for being so brave. and don't be embarrassed, because this is the truth. No matter what race you are, no matter what your background is, it's something that you have to acknowledge, and you have to incorporate our ideal of keeping it out of the decision-making process, identifying where it is instead of just pretending it's not there.
So I will tell Jerry when I see him next week that you have done him proud by your recounting. But that's exactly what he does, and it's in its real appropriate way. But you know what?
Before we run out of time,
I wanted to talk about what happened in Milwaukee and the police shooting of yet another young black man who, and it's unclear from what exactly happened factually, because the police are just kind of mum on the word, other than the fact that this young man had a gun, supposedly, and he was running from the police. Which, of course, raises the issue. If he was running from the police, you know, how do they shoot a man running away, right?
Well, we don't know any of those details.
We don't know any of those details.
Point.
But what we do know what happened is social media caught wind of this, and people converged on that scene, and riots broke out. And there was a gas station burned, and there was a number of other businesses that were destroyed, a hair salon and a number of others. And it garnered national news. And to the extent I think that it was portrayed as being a sort of L.A. riot-sized thing, when actually it was a very small area and a very small
and
number of people
I caught
involved.
That, too, because the only news that was covered on the news stations, like during the overnight hours, was they were there chomping at the bit, waiting for something to happen, like it was going to be a glorious thing for the news channels.
Well, sure. Well, they're looking to get Pulitzers or something, you know, or some journalistic prize. But the bottom line is that everybody. First of all, it made Milwaukee look bad. But be that aside, a lot of folks that live in that area, they're not surprised that violence broke out. Even if this kid was not a very defensible kid, not like a Dontre Hamilton, who was an unarmed, mentally ill black man in the downtown park who was shot 14 times by a police officer. But that was, you know, if you really look at the cumulative effect of racial discrimination in the inner city of Milwaukee for decades and decades and decades and decades, that this has been going on, and police abuse in those neighborhoods, that's what sparked this type of reaction.
And
it wasn't just this one incident.
One way that I think you could put it is the potential for unrest is kind of almost constantly at about 211 degrees, and it doesn't take much for it to boil over. And something that, you know, social media is one of those things that I think is an interesting dynamic in our society because of how quickly people can communicate with each other. But you know what? As I was watching some of the news feeds that were going across Facebook and Twitter, things that were coming across, people have some pretty ignorant opinions about what's going on in the world. And the thing that drove me crazy was all the people out there that, first of all, don't know what happened. Secondly, don't know really what's happening right now. But yet they know what the problem is, which is all these people are animals. That's what I heard a lot of. These people are animals, and all you got to do is turn your back for one second, and they'll pounce on you like a tiger.
I know.
Ridiculous.
And I get that from the police I talk to, and I get that from people around the country that I would talk to, and they want to know what's going on in Milwaukee. What they don't know is the history of what happened here. I mean, if you really look at it, this city was settled by a huge migration of blacks from the South in the 40s and 50s, because there was a lot of manufacturing jobs up in the North, and they settled in the Detroits and the Clevelands and the Milwaukees and the Chicagos, and they had decent jobs. You didn't have to have a high school diploma to work in some of these manufacturing jobs. And then those manufacturing jobs disappeared in the 70s and 80s, or a lot of them moved to the suburbs. And then many people of many minorities found themselves trapped in substandard living conditions on the north side of Milwaukee without stable jobs, and there was blatant discrimination to not lend to people, to not lend to people in the inner city, to keep this hyper segregation in place. And that's what led to riots in Milwaukee in 1967. I know you didn't live here at the time, but Father Garoppi.
Hey, John. Yep. Unfortunately, we're out of time, so we'll have to pick up with this next week. Right? You know, it starts getting, it just builds momentum, and then it's great. And then we got to.
All right. Well, we have a whole show on that one, so.
Yeah. Okay. Sounds good. Enjoy your weekend, everybody. Tune in next week, as you can every weekend, right here on 1330 WHBL and 101.5 FM. This has been Legal Defense with Kirk and John. Have a good weekend.